oceans apart, day after day, and I slowly go insane. I hear your voice on the line, but it doesn't stop the pain. If I see you next to never, then how can we see?
When I was a child, before life removed all the innocence, my father would lift me high and dance with my mother and me, and then spin me around till I fell asleep. Up the stairs he would carry me, and I knew for sure I was loved.
And joining us right now is a singer, songwriter, producer, music impresario, Richard Marx. And Richard, I got to tell you a story I've told here at PMP Network before, because I have a young daughter who's 9, and
right.
I was lying in bed with her, putting her to sleep, and a song came on the air that made me cry in front of my daughter. And it was a song called Dance with My Father. And I didn't know who it was. I didn't know anything about it. All I know is I started bawling like mad. And
well, it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, it was, because my dad passed away, and I was thinking about him. So I was pretty much bawling away, and she's like, why?
Well,
are you
that
so
song
sad?
Sure had that effect on a lot of people.
It is an amazing song, and of course, I later found out it was sung by Luther Vandross, but I more recently found out that you actually co-wrote it with him.
Yeah.
Is your dad alive?
No, I lost my dad about 6 or 7 years ago, so, you know, this certainly resonates with me too, you know.
Yeah.
But I can't take any credit for the lyric on this one. I wrote the music, and Luther, about a year ago, year and change, he called me. We've written together before, and we've been friends for a long time. And he called me up with an idea that he had going about his dad, who he lost when he was really young. I think when he was only, you know, 9 or 10 years old or something.
Yeah.
But he had these sort of vague, distant memories of his dad, and his most vivid memory of his dad was his dad would dance with the kids and his wife in the kitchen of their house. So, you know, we all have, you know, certain memories that really stand out, and that was Luther. So, you know, I sent him this piece of music, and what he wrote to it was just this sort of, you know, diary of his dad.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the really cruel irony is that you know, just like a month or so before the song came out, Luther had this horrible stroke. And so we haven't really had a chance to celebrate the success of this song. I mean,
he has children as well, right?
He has no children now.
Oh, he doesn't, okay.
But, you know, the stroke was massive, and he's got a long, long road ahead to recover. And so he's kind of still in a place where he's not really aware of how much this song is affecting people, how much this album has been so successful. And I mean, I firmly am a believer that if anybody can come back, it'll be him. But that's the really cruel irony, is that, you know, I get these calls and emails from people about this song, and I can't really celebrate it, because my friend and co-writer, you know, I can't clink champagne glasses with him right now. So it's a really, you know, it's a very emotional thing, you know, in so many different ways, not just the song and how it affects people like yourself, but, you know, as the writer of it and the co-writer of it, I can't call out my pal and say, look how great our song's doing, or, you know, it's somewhat of an empty feeling.
I have a feeling it's going to end up being a regular at bar mitzvahs and weddings and things like that where a parent is missing.
Yeah, you know, there are times when songs take on lives of their own, and that's really amazing. It's a privilege, you know, for me to write a song about my wife that's really deeply personal to me, and then have, you know, people use it as their wedding song or their whatever. It's It's not ever anything I think we intend as songwriters. It's just an amazing accident.
Mm. Well, you have written so many songs that I didn't even realize how busy you are. When people out there are listening to the charts and hearing songs like Someday, which Vince Gill did, and
right.
And so a lot of the stuff that you're hearing from Emerson Drive, and you know, there's all these songs that are out there that you've had a part in. Another one, the Only God song, Only God Could Stop Me From Loving You. Some great stuff out there. What is it that inspires you to write? I mean, is it in your head? I know for me, when I write, it's like someone's dictating and I'm dissipating right into the paper. And if I have an emotional feeling, but what is it that starts you writing?
Well, you know what? I don't even know that I have an answer to that question. I've been writing since I was about 15 or 16 years old. I've been writing songs, and I think when I was just starting to write, I was emulating. You know, I was emulating Billy Joel and Elton John and people who, and Paul Simon, and songwriters that whose songwriting really affected me. And also, you know, back in the old, to the old stuff. I mean, Sam Cooke died, I think, a year or two after I was born. But when I loved Sam Cooke growing up. I loved his voice. And then when I found out that he wrote all those songs, something just clicked, and I thought, you know, that's really what I want to do. I want to write songs. And the singing part of it sort of took a back seat. And when I first moved out to California from Chicago to pursue a career in the music business, it wasn't to try and make it as a singer. It was to see if I could, you know, find any success as a songwriter and hopefully as a producer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of stumbled upon a record deal a couple of years after that and had a, you know, really fortunate run for 7 or 8 years on the radio. And but even during all those times of writing songs for myself as an artist, I was always writing when time permitted, you know, for other artists. And I always knew that was going to be my future. And I think I'm sort of sidestepping your question because I really don't know how to answer where the songs come from. I think it's probably pretty much like what you just said. You know, sometimes I sit down because I know that I have to come up with something for a particular purpose. But for the most part, I only write when I feel like writing, and luckily for me, I feel like writing all the time. So I think that's got to, I mean, I believe it comes from a higher place, and you know, mm-hmm. I think these songs come through me, not from me, you know?
I feel the same way.
Yeah.
What is a bigger thrill, though? I mean, writing a song and having it, you know, for instance, a song like, you know, Right Here Waiting, which climbs the charts with your voice on it, or one like Dance With My Father, which you wrote with someone else?
Well, you know, I hate to sound like I'm complaining because it's not a complaint, but you have to understand, I mean, when you have a number one single as an artist, the glamorous part of that is pretty much non-existent, because what it takes to have a hit record, to have a number one record especially, is just a tremendous amount of work and sacrifice. And, you know, I actually, to be honest with you, I recall that period of a couple of years where I had a few number ones in a row. I don't really remember it. You know, I was touring. I was in Australia when Right Here Waiting went to number one. I was on a concert stage in Australia, and I wasn't with my wife or my parents or my friends celebrating. I was working. And it was great, and I'm really grateful for that success, but I didn't get to enjoy it, really. And now, you know, as a husband and father of three kids, and, you know, I'm home most of the time now. So when I have, you know, my favorite example is the NSYNC song that I wrote a few years ago called This I Promise You. When I wrote and produced that, I would see the guys in NSYNC on Good Morning America, and I'd start laughing because I know that they got up at 4:30 that morning, and they had to, you know, climb out of bed and somehow get their voices together and sing, and I'm sitting there having a cup of coffee. You know, these young kids are doing all the work, you know.
Right.
So, and it's the same for Vince Gill or whatever. I mean, you know, Vince and I laugh about it. He's been out on the promo trail, you know, working it and really working hard, and I'm, you know, not. I get to have the fun part, which is, it's a tremendous amount of work, but it's not the legwork. It's not the getting on the bus. It's not getting on the plane. It's a lot of hours of creativity in the studio. But so to answer your question, I think I actually prefer what's going on now the last few years, because it allows me to have a life on top of being a creative person. I get to, you know, have all this fun success as a songwriter and producer, but I still get to tuck my kids in every night. You know, that's
a good point.
That's
interesting. I've spoken to hundreds of singers here, and the ones who really enjoyed their you know, success times were mostly the ones who didn't write the songs.
Yeah,
and those are the guys that aren't making any money off those songs
exactly.
either.
exactly.
It's really kind of sad.
The truth is that I never thought of myself as a singer who wrote songs. It was always the opposite. I always thought of myself as a songwriter who happened to sing. And I've just been really fortunate. You know, I don't think it's. I've tried to figure out why more guys from my time, who I've been lumped with, you know, Brian Adams and Michael Bolton and guys like that. I mean, some of whom I work with and really like as friends. I've always wondered why they didn't sort of segue the way I did. And I think it's just you either sort of have that mindset or you don't. And you know, I knew that there would come a time in my career when I'd hit a wall as a singer, when you know, all of a sudden I'd put out a song that wasn't a hit, and I knew that day would come. Luckily, it didn't come for a long time, but when it did come, it didn't shock me and it didn't freak me out. It made me go, okay, what do I do now? Now I really throw myself into writing and producing, and I've been really fortunate to have great opportunities come my way. And I also have to point out, you know, the the real great gift of the last few years is the variety of music that I've been able to do. I mean, as a singer, I couldn't get away with a country song or an R&B song or, you know, some heavy rock and roll song. But as a writer and producer, I get to do all of it. You know, I get to go from NSYNC to Josh Groban to Vince Gill to Emerson Drive to the Tubes, and nobody raises a red flag and goes, "You can't do that." So it's pretty cool.
That is kind of cool. And what you mentioned earlier, I think, has a lot of credence based on the talks I've had, including some with folks that you even mentioned, who are singers primarily and have tried songwriting, but they're not songwriters. You can't just say, well, okay, I'm going to be a songwriter now. You are one or you're not one.
I don't know that that's exactly true, though. You know, I think that there's a level of craft, and I think everybody's well is a certain depth. And you know, there are a couple of people who are not known as songwriters. I mean, Eric Clapton's not really known as a songwriter, I don't think. He's known as the greatest guitar player in the world.
But he's written some songs we all know.
But he's written some really great songs.
Great
but
songs,
he's not.
Yeah.
I don't think people put Eric Clapton in the songwriter category, you know.
No.
And maybe that, I'm sure I could, you know, come up with a better example. But, you know, every once in a while, you'll just run across a song that an artist wrote that they very rarely write a song. And when they do, it's really great. It doesn't mean that they can be prolific and come up with that, you know, time after time. But some of the great songs out there, you know, have been sort of stumbled upon by some great singer. So you never know.
Yeah, most of those singers I've talked to, though, that aren't known for songwriting have written a song or two on every album because it's economically feasible to do that.
Yeah, and that's kind of bugs all of us. You know, all of us, you know, that slave away at trying to write the best material. And I've been in a couple of situations where I've co-written with an artist and gave that artist a free ride, you know, and it's, I don't think the artist ends up feeling very good about it either. I mean, he'll cash the check, but at the end of the day, that's how you weed people out, you know. And I love writing with artists because I think sometimes I can bring something to them that they might not stumble upon themselves, you know. And, and I also like being able to tailor a song for that person's voice with them in the room singing it. And you kind of just know where you're going. But, yeah, you're right. There are a lot of, you know, when you see you know, an album where the artist is listed as one of seven writers, you know, probably that artist, you know, was sitting on the phone doing their nails, you know, while the song was being written, but they got a piece of the song.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned all the different people you've written with so many different people, everybody from, you know, Luther to, you know, Richie McDonald from Lone Star, but even your wife. I know you've written some stuff with her. Tell me a little bit about what it's like to write with the wife.
Well, we've only written a couple of songs together. We wrote a song years ago when she had a brief stint in this group, Animotion, and we wrote a song for that album, and it was great fun. I mean, she wrote the lyrics, and I wrote the music. And
I'm thinking of actually Perfect Day.
Well, Perfect Day is just in the last year, and that was a blast because, number one, it was a challenge for me. It was for an artist named Chris Botti, who's a jazz trumpet player in Sting's band, and he also makes jazz records on the side. And Chris is a friend of mine, and he's not really a singer, but he's kind of got that kind of Chet Baker, really smoky, cool voice. And for me, it was a great challenge because I used all these chord changes that I never use, you know, chord changes that I had never used before. And, you know, it's just, it spoke to me in a really romantic way. And I thought, I'm going to take this to Cynthia and see if we can write this lyric together. And so we wrote this sort of, it's a day in a romantic winter, you know, and it's song that a lot of people I'm sure won't ever hear, but it's one of my favorite things just because it's such a mood setter. And you know what, in the case of Cynthia, she's she doesn't consider herself a songwriter. She just comes up with great ideas, you know, and so she doesn't have an ego about it. So if she comes up with a line that I'm not really sure fits or sings right, she doesn't have any, she's not defensive about it. She'll go, okay, well, how do we make this work, you know? Mm-hmm. So she's a great collaborator that way. And
how long have you been married?
We've been married since 1989, so we're coming up on 15 years.
You have a couple boys, right?
We have three boys.
Three boys?
I have the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, and are any of them musicians?
They're all musicians. I mean, they're still young, 13, yeah. 11, and 9, but
yeah.
They're all, my oldest son, Brandon, plays drums and guitar, and my middle son, Lucas, plays piano and guitar, and my youngest son, Jesse, plays piano, and he's got perfect pitch, and they all sing great. So I think that they have the ability to have musical careers if they want, but I want them to do whatever they want to do that makes them happy.
Well, they could be the Marx Brothers.
They could be.
Yeah, that would be kind of an interesting move.
Be pretty scary.
You mentioned that your dad was a jazz guy. Did he teach you to play instruments?
No, he was one of the greatest jazz pianists, I mean, ever. I mean, it's, you know, it's easy for me to say that, but I mean, he used to have, you know, Count Basie and Duke Ellington and guys like that come to see him play here in Chicago, and he refused to teach me, and I think that's wise. It's like, it's the same reason that I wouldn't teach my kids, because you need an objective teacher. And my dad had a really great career as a jingle composer and producer for my whole lifetime. But before that was really when he was playing jazz in the clubs and stuff like that. So he was just a brilliant musician, period. He was an orchestrator and conductor, and I worked with him quite a bit on my records, and he did arrangements for me and stuff. So we got to work together a bunch.
That's kind of nice.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. Now you were singing his tunes when you were like 5, weren't you?
I started doing jingles when I was 5 years old, and I just sort of, you know, I used to sing around the house to the Monkees and to the Beatles, and so my parents said, well, let's have him try and do this Peter Pan peanut butter commercial, and that was it. You know, I started doing all these commercials, these kid kind of commercials for Nestle's Crunch Bars and Sugar Frosted Flakes and stuff like that. And what was really fun about it was, aside from missing school now and then, was basically growing up in my dad's recording studio in the city. And you know, back then, the musicians would come in and do the track. In a lot of cases, it would be a full orchestra with horns and brass and strings and all kinds of, you know, percussion and stuff. And so I'd watch all this go down and then go out and sing. So by the time I was 18 or 19 and I moved out to L.A., a recording studio was like my living room. I was really comfortable there, so I had a head start.
Talking about recording studios, I understand that you started your own, and you started your own label.
Well, I did my own independent album on a label that I started with a friend of mine a few years ago, and it was only a vehicle for that particular record. And I learned from that experience that at the end of the day, you can have all this ideology and pie in the sky, but at the end of the day, you have to get the records in the stores. So we had to rely on a big distributor, and it was just like being on a record company again. So it was sort of like a disappointing experience. I'm doing a new album, which will be out in the spring, and I'm actually back on the label that I originally signed with, EMI Manhattan, and the reason is that the guy who runs it is a guy named Bruce Lundvall, who's been in the music business forever, and signed Nora Jones last year, and we've always been friends, and he's the guy that signed me originally. I just trust him, so I'm kind of back in the major label game, but singing is my hobby now, you know.
Like
I'm not going to let anything interfere with the writer-producer thing, but I do have a studio here in Chicago at my house, and I don't rent it out to anybody else. Luckily, I'm busy enough that I keep it working just with my own projects, but it's so great to have my own studio here so I don't have to go away as much.
Do you ever find yourself writing jingles like Dad?
No. You know what? When I was about 17 or 18, my dad offered me a job at his place, and I actually had a little office there, and I think I lasted a week. I just knew that I'd never be as good as he was. My dad had this knack of being able to write hit songs in 30 seconds. And, you know, I get the luxury of 4 minutes, you know.
Right.
I just could never do that. I could never be as good as he was, and I never wanted to compete with that. So, you know, I went and did my thing, and he was really thrilled and supportive, and he wasn't really a songwriter, so we kind of marveled at each other's work, and it was probably the best way.
Hmm. I did a something called the Bachelor Bid out here in Boston a few years ago for cystic fibrosis. Although I don't know anybody that has that disease, I thought the foundation was an excellent foundation, and I worked hard to make some money one night for them. Mm-hmm. And I know that you've been involved in something called the All-Star Music Bash, the Gibson Baldwin All-Star Music Bash, and it's coming up Thursday at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about your involvement in the thing, and also some great talent on the roster that night too.
Well, a few years ago, I mean, I didn't know anybody who had cystic fibrosis. To be honest with you, I wasn't even really positive what it was. And you know, over my career, I've been fortunate enough to be asked to participate in all different kinds of charity events, and I've always loved that. I always consider that a privilege. And there are almost no causes that aren't needy. It's
right.
Just there are certain causes that really resonate with you or that really strike you more than others for whatever reason. And cystic fibrosis was just, I went to them because there was something compelling me to find out about it, to see what I could do to help. And I was really glad I did because it's a horrific disease that affects about 30,000 people a year, mostly children. And basically the effects of the disease cause the person to suffocate. It's just a buildup of this thick mucus in their lungs. It's genetic. There's no cure. And because the death toll is not bigger, our government doesn't fund it, doesn't fund a cure.
Mm.
So they completely rely on independent fundraising. And so I just, you know, what most of us rely on for those kind of fundraisers are concerts, you know, benefit concerts. And luckily I can pull together, you know, different names of people. So we started this in Nashville where the foundation, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, is based 3 years ago. And, you know, the first show was me and Vince Gill and Amy Grant and Kenny Loggins and Kenny Chesney and Jamie O'Neill and She Daisy and Michael W. Smith, the Christian artist. And it was like just a slew of people. And we had a big dinner and a concert, and it raised a bunch of money, and we were really happy. And then last year we had another one with Keith Urban and Nick Lachey from 98 Degrees and my friends Emerson Drive and Clint Black. And again, a really great event. The only thing I felt the last 2 years is that when you combine a show like that with a dinner and an auction, people get tired. I mean, it's like a four-hour thing.
It's long, yeah.
So this year I said, let's just do a concert. So we're at the Ryman Auditorium. It's myself, Kenny Loggins, and Lone Star, and we're going to have a couple surprise guests, but that's going to be the meat of the show. And I just think it'll be interesting. You know, it's kind of a cross-section of pop and country fans, hopefully, who will be attending, and all the money goes to research to find a cure for cystic fibrosis. And, you know, the other thing that's really exciting about this particular cause is that the cure for this disease is absolutely imminent and within our reach. It's not like some other diseases where there's just no cure on the horizon. This is just heartbeats away. So, you know, the more money we can raise, the faster we'll find the cure.
And for folks out that way that want to go, it is not an expensive event. Yeah, there are VIP tickets and things, but the tickets start at $24.50, so
yeah,
anybody can
afford
to go. Yeah,
it's just a concert. Come and hang out. Plus, if you've never been to the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, you've never been to a concert. It's the greatest place to see a show.
How many people does it hold?
I don't know, a couple thousand.
Yeah, so it's a nice intimate atmosphere.
It's intimate. It's a great sounding room, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Folks, if you want to get tickets for that event, you can call 615-255-9600 or go to www.ticketmaster.com and ask for the All-Star Music Bash. So I know you're still producing and writing. What are you involved with at this current moment?
Well, I'm finishing up my record, which is almost done. I just finished the new album for Emerson Drive, which will be out sometime in the next few months. I'm producing an artist that's a European artist that will be trying to sort of break here in America. Her name is Sissel, and she's a young classical singer. She's kind of like Enya a little bit, kind of, I mean, for lack of a better description, sort of a female Josh Groban.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been fun because I'm working with orchestra, and I, you know, I get to act like a grown-up, you know, instead of doing a rock record or a, you know, jangly guitar record.
Yeah. Josh Groban was an amazing success. We had him on the show here when he first started, when he was on Ally McBeal.
Right.
And now, which songs on the CD did you write?
I wrote and produced the single, To Where You Are.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that. Wow.
Yeah, in
That's
fact, it's funny because that song was not actually supposed to be on his record. Josh, for whatever reasons, just decided he didn't want to put it on his debut album. And totally by accident, the producer of Ally McBeal, David E. Kelly, heard the song and wrote an episode around the song and
right.
then said, you know, let's have Josh sing it. And so it was almost like it forced it to be on the album. And the next thing you knew, it was number one, and then the album just went crazy. So thank God for small miracles, you know.
Isn't that amazing, though, huh?
Yeah, well, you never know. I mean, you know, show business is weird.
So this young lady, you think that she's got the potential to be a big pop star as well?
Well, I don't know about a big pop star in the traditional sense. I think she has the ability to capture that adult audience that's, you know, just dying for something to listen to, because she's really got a great voice, and she's more seasoned than a Josh Groban. You know, Josh is still young. Sissel's got, you know, she's got a daughter. She's lived life. She's got a lot of emotion in her singing, and aside from having a great instrument, you know. So I think that the audiences that love Enya or that love Josh, or even the audiences that love stuff like Norah Jones, will love this girl, and she's really charming, and so we have really high hopes for her. So I'm doing a handful of songs on her record, and then I'll dive into a bunch of new stuff in the beginning of the year.
Have you been able to get a word to Luther Vandross at all?
I went to see him, actually.
You did go to see him?
Yeah, I went to New York to see him. And,
did he recognize you?
Some of the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's he goes in and out of recognizing and remembering certain things, but it's, you have to understand, I mean, the stroke that he suffered was so severe that it's amazing he's alive. Like I said, he's got a really long road, but if anybody can come back, it's him. And, you know, he physically was surprisingly good. It looked great to me. I mean, I was really expecting him to look horrible, and he looked great. It's just, you know, putting the pieces back together and, you know, and recalling things, and it's going to take a long time, but I think he can do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
My pleasure.
And also thanks for some of the great songs you've written.
Oh, thanks, man. I'm
making
glad
me cry in front of my daughter, you know.
Yeah, you know what, though? I mean, for a song to produce that kind of emotion, that's just awesome. I'm really glad to hear it.
Well, I'm glad to hear it too, but that you can be that powerful with people in terms of your songwriting. But try to make them laugh a little more next time rather than.
I'll work on it.
All right, take care.
Thanks, you too.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.